Okay, can you all hear me? Good. So I wanted to thank the organizers for having me here. I've been enjoying all the talks, both in their delivery and content, and the discussions that followed after the talks and during the talks. So I hope I learned something, and I'll take it back to my students at Florida State University, where I'm currently an assistant professor in mineral physics. So Kanani gave me the task of talking about the effects of water, and that's what I'm going to talk about. But before we understand the effects of water, we would first have to understand, is there any water or not? And sadly enough, I mean, I'll probably stop my journey at the bottom of the transition zone, after which large consensus is that there's probably less water. So effects of water will be kind of redundant, so I don't know how much I will be able to contribute in terms of the large-scale heterogeneities that you might be observing in the deep mantle. Okay, ask questions whenever you need. If I'm not looking at you, just speak up. I'll try and address all the questions to the best of my knowledge. It's a very vast field. There might be some limitations that I have, and then, of course, senior colleagues could chime in. This is a picture showing ocean worth of water inside the planet Earth. It comes from the artist's rendition of Jules Verne's The Journey to the Center of the Earth. I also added this one, that water may not be in the liquid state. It might be hidden somewhere in the crystalline state, and of course, large crystals and so on. Very fascinating. In fact, this has made to the Nature article, which reported Wolfskiite with water in the diamond a couple of years ago from Canada and Canadian researchers, Graham Pearson and so on. So just to give you what I will be talking about and what I will not be talking about, first of all, water and solid earth, why bother? It does influence melting processes. Zicheng covered the melting processes, and also Crystal talked about influence of melting on partitioning of cations and also deep melting. Lars talked about elastic property, and Carolina also mentioned a bit about the deep subduction and whether minor elements will have any effect on the elastic property or not, and I'll show you some recent results that have appeared just a few days ago, perhaps, or perhaps months ago, on whether there is any effect of water on elastic properties, particularly seismic velocities, the elastic part of the seismic velocities, if I get there. The other thing is, does it affect transport property? It's a very important topic. Does it affect viscosity, or how does it affect rheological flow laws? It's known that water does have effect of hydrolytic weakening in quartz, but quartz is not the dominant phase in the mantle, so what are the effects of water in olivine or the main pyrolytic rheology? How much is known, and you know how we can interpret the data. How is water transported into the deep earth? It's mostly through subduction zone, a group of minerals called hydrophases. That's what I have been working on for the past several years. They are very interesting phases. They're very minor in abundance. However, they leave geophysical traces and signatures like anisotropy, elastic anisotropy and high electrical conductivity when they dehydrate. So it's a very fascinating topic. However, for this particular audience, I'll be talking about the bulk mantle, which is dominated by drier mineral phase where water is available as trace quantities. Okay? Oh, so before I move forward, I'll try and refresh our memory. This is something Kanani talked about, the linking of the tetrahedra as the mineral becomes more complex, and I'm putting together balanced reaction series on this particular diagram where you see that high temperatures, olivine and pyroxene, are the minerals that are stable. As you go towards lower temperature, the connectivity of the silicon tetrahedra becomes quite complex, and I'll show you that in a minute. And to have charge balance, you often will have hydrogen in hydroxyl groups, and they are oftentimes water-bearing mineral phases. The other way of looking at it is that when magma crystallizes, the first phase to crystallize will be essentially dry phases, and as the magma then gets enriched in water, if there is water there, then you will have water-rich minerals like amphibole and biotite. And then you can revert this, and you can study weathering processes, and the weathering processes will tell you that we have rocks which are probably crystallized at high temperatures, and they are now interacting with the hydrosphere. So the ultimate sink will be something like silica and hydrophases, because we have water surrounding the rocks. So you'll have muscovite, quartz, and K feldspar. Either ways, these are stable at lower conditions, lower temperature pressure conditions. These are all hydrous, and these are not hydrous. Am I going too fast? Okay. Having an Indian accent, it can interfere. With so do let me know. Okay. So this is a sheet silicate where you have this as a fundamental unit, and I can construct a variety of minerals with it. You have the fundamental unit. You can charge balance it with 3 magnesium. You can create a mineral called serpentine. You can have this is a tetrahedral layer like this, and a magnesium layer. You can have a tetrahedral layer sandwiching an octahedral layer that can create talc, and then you can have an additional interlayer cation, which can then have potassium in it, and you can have muscovite and biotite and phlogopite and so on and so forth. This is a cartoon that I made. This is mid-ocean ridge basalt area where you form oceanic plates, and as the oceanic plates cool, they will have cooling-related cracks, and it is in contact with water. Esteban talked about this. So the water will interact with this this crack, and it will probably react and form minerals such as serpentine, where this is a dry mineral called olivine. It's an island silicate, and this is a chain silicate. They will react with some amount of water, and it can stabilize hydrous phases. And then these hydrous phases can be then dragged along the plate. As the plate becomes denser and it sinks, the hydrous phases will be taken down. But as I mentioned, these hydrous phases are quite stable at superficial conditions, so they will probably reach their thermodynamic stability, both in terms of pressure and temperature, and then they will dehydrate. Part of it, water will be released, and it will form arc magmas, where exactly the temperature isotherms are concentrated. If there were no plate tectonics, this hydration process, if it were to continue unhindered, the estimate is that within 2 billion years, all the water of the ocean will be desiccated. You can imagine, you have a huge amount of silicate, and you have a tiny sliver of ocean on top. If the reaction goes unhindered, it'll just soak up all the water, and everything will be hydrous phase. But that doesn't happen, fortunately. You have this arc magmas, which forms continents eventually, where we live, and so on. So this plate tectonics actually help conserve the water on the surface of the Earth. Okay. Hydrous phases, it's not as complex as lead isotope plots, but it could get complicated. It could get complicated, and I'll spare you from that. Hydrous phases have several weight persons of H2O. When you measure the mass, hydrogen atoms are in distinct crystallographic site. That means if you have a periodicity of crystal unit cells, hydrogen will occur exactly at the same place in the next periodic unit cell. And you can probe that using neutron or X-ray, and you can find out the hydrogen position, which is not going to happen for the nominal anhydrous phase, because the hydrogen occurs as a defect there. They have limited thermal stability. What do I mean by that? This is a pressure and temperature diagram. Pressure increases in this axis. That means if you are subducting the slab, you will encounter this sort of pressure range as you go to deeper and deeper realms of the mantle. And this is the temperature. This is a mantle geotherm. And most of the hydrous phases have their boundaries lower than the mantle geotherm. That means they are not stable in the normal mantle geotherm. Although amphibole have probably the highest temperature stabilities, but still they are oftentimes not stable in the normal mantle adiabat. This is the oceanic lithosphere adiabat for almost 100 million years of age, and this is the Archean cretonic lithosphere. Some hydrous phases might have been stable in these kind of conditions, extreme hydrous phases like pargasite, amphibole, and so on, but most of it is not stable. However, the oceanic geotherms are often on the colder side. There are, of course, warm subduction zone. Sorry, I take it back. I said ocean. Subduction zone geotherms are on the colder side. There are, of course, hotter subduction zone and colder subduction zone. Rita showed that in one of her plot. And some of the hydrous phases could be stable there. At lower pressures, the hydrous phases have oftentimes very large volume layered structures. But as you go to deeper realms, these hydrous phases become dense, and silicon is in octahedral coordination, and they can withstand pressure. Question is, can they withstand temperature? And towards the end, if I can reach there, I'll show you that there are some new recent studies which show that they can withstand high temperature as well, and they might be stable in the lower mantle. However, proper bulk composition needs to be there for them to be stable. Okay. This is a diagram that I've taken from Pauli and Schmidt, showing the variety of hydrous phases. Along with that, the carbonates are also shown over there. This is calcite, dolomite, magnesite. This is the stability limit of amphibole, zoisite, chloritoid. Chlorite has a large stability field. It's stable at high temperature, but then antigorite, and this is the 10 angstrom phase. and then you have all the dense phases and so on. If you go to a different composition of the oceanic crust, which is shown over here in the gray, different kinds of minerals are stable. And then if you consider the sediments or continental crust, whole different kinds of minerals are stable. Minor amounts, but they could be stable. The advantage of those are they are stable at higher temperature with the alumina content being larger, and they could retain the water, not dehydrate, and perhaps show up in the signatures in the OIB, which is oftentimes more water rich. That's hydrostase. Yes.
So is the A in the bottom left of the subduction zone say that some of the other hydrostases change into that and become stable in that?
Yeah, it's like, if I understand the question correctly, it says that there will be a whole suite of hydrostases which are very dense, A and D, and there were lots of terminologies that were used and identification had issues in terms of crystallography. These are dense hydrostases, do not have names, so alphabet names are used because they're not seen in nature. Only seen in experiments most of the time, and they can take water in cold subduction zones. And then once the slab is subducted and if it heats up, they will probably release the water. If you change the composition to more alumina-rich, probably they can survive. And there are newer phases that have been discovered in recent times. Hopefully I'll be able to talk about it. Yes, yes, Mark.
Perhaps like most seismologists or many seismologists, I tend to consume the information on here like in cartoon form.
Yeah.
You know, the information about what phases are stable where. And I don't have a great sense for exactly how well known all the underlying data about the stability is known. I mean, is this super well worked out? And it's like if you know the geotherm, then you know where everything should be, or is there more uncertainty than might be suggested by the cartoon?
It's mostly stable in the colder geotherm. Experiments have been done and they have been repeated. There could be kinetics issues, but and then you have to just plug it in with this sort of subduction zone diagram where you know you take your favored geotherm from Syracuse. If you're using it for Tonga or some kind of colder subduction zone, yes, it's very likely that there will be some hydrostase that will probably be stable. If you are going for a hotter subduction zone, then they will probably dehydrate.
So it's like pretty well.
Experiments are, yeah, they're reproducible. The experiments have been done both in Europe and in Japan, and they do. And also here in ASU, Holloway did lots of experiments in early times in which many of the hydrostases were
Question, I'm going to follow up on that. Let's assume, I believe this cartoon is pretty correct. I mean, from a geodynamic point of view, I don't know much about it. Let's assume it's all correct, it's all based on mineral physics. Then my question is, how applicable this is related to the real Earth? Because I mean, mineral physics is like look at small samples, like crystal scale processes, right?
Yeah
we can measure the PT condition of dewatering or whatever. But in reality, the slab is like 100 kilometers thick. I mean, if you say have water within the slab, I mean, the fact that water will leave the crystal does not necessarily mean it will leave the slab, right? I mean, the water, I see.
I mean,
hydrous mineral becomes anhydrous in a lab in a crystal scale doesn't mean it will, you know, dehydrate the entire slab.
What you're suggesting is that water leaves the mineral as it dehydrates, and it will probably go into a pore space. How long will pore space survive at high pressure?
I don't know.
So then the question is, what will the water do? And probably the water will react with the normal mantle. And that normal mantle has minerals like olivine, and I'll try and show you how much water can olivine and other dry minerals can take. That's what the
right. But one more step is like you have to move the water from the interior of the slab to the ambient mantle. Tens of kilometers distance. Right?
Yeah. That's right. Water at this condition is not like normal water. You will see that the fugacity of the water is so high that it can in fact melt through rocks, and I'll show you examples of that. This is not a normal water that it will just react with a solid phase and it will produce a hydrostase. This can create reactive transport. And Mark Spiegelman has this melt reactive transport. Water can also do that. And I'll show you sometime and I will pictures to convince you that how corrosive this water is.
Okay.
You have a question there? Yes.
Just want to briefly comment on this the diagram you show. This is for equilibrium, right? This is
Yeah, so I don't want to go to non-equilibrium, please.
Yeah, but I think it's possible that for the subducted slab, that part of it's not equilibrium, so that we can have some phase, because if it's non-equilibrium, because it depends on kinetics, how this phase transition occurs, right?
What you're talking about is essentially the main transition, let's say, from olivine to wadsleyite or ringwoodite, and how water is going to affect yes, there are kinetic effects. If it is cold, then it will behave in a different way. Then there are wedges of olivine which survives very deep. Yeah, that's there, but I'm not going to talk about that. I'm going to talk about much basic stuff. But you'll see how complicated even that basic stuff is. Yes. Yes, green growth is affected by water. There are studies by Otani and also Corrado and others have looked into this. Yeah.
So would the presence of water offset the potential for metastable?
Yeah. I mean, it shifts the boundaries of transition. It can also affect the green growth. There are various ways in which water can affect that. You're dragging me away from my comfort zone. So I don't want to comment, and this is all recorded. So. So what I'm going to do today is talk about some natural observations, which are very crucial because, you know, this all business of water, whether it's there at all in the minerals, do we see them in minerals? And how do we study those? What are the caveats? And then I'll hopefully be able to demonstrate that it's very challenging to get meaningful things out of water from crystals. And then I'll say, well, we need to do some experiments. And before we do experiments, we need to have some understanding of what to expect from the experiments. So we'll construct some thermodynamic models. And there I will hopefully able to tease out effects of fugacity, which we have been hearing every now and then, fugacity of oxygen, which is the redox potential, with the effects of water. Then I'll show you some solubility results. I don't know how long I will survive. And then finally, I'll go to physical properties, how it affects velocity, how it affects transport properties, and so on. Okay. This is inspired by Esterman. This is another slide, which is a thin section of a crystal, a peridotitic crystal. What you see over here, these light regions are olivine, and these colored regions are diopside, which is a pyroxene, and also Enstite. These are two pyroxene. One is having calcium and magnesium. The other one is completely magnesium and membrane. And this pink thing that you see is garnet. As it goes to higher pressure, this pink thing, which is garnet, will react with these guys' green stuff, and they will form a mineral called majorite as you go towards the transition zone. So the field of garnet will increase, and this is largely like 60% of the rock that you have in the mantle. So the question is, how much water can these guys have? And what is the effect of water on these minerals? That's what the bulk of the mantle is. Ringwood did some experiments, and you have seen a variety of form of this in Carolinas and Lars's talk, in which they have looked into the mixing of oceanic material and the pyrolytic material, and they have come up with a mechanical mixture model. But this is just the pyrolite. This is the thin section that you saw. This is olivine, the major component, and then it transforms to Watsonite and Ringwoodite. On the other side, you have the orthopyroxene and clinopyroxene, which are both pyroxenes. I'm not showing plagioclase and other kind of alumina phases which occur at shallower part. And these guys will react with garnet, and the stability field of garnet will become quite large. If you are considering more basalt, this garnet will be quite dominant, and that will be like almost 80% or so, with a little bit of stishovite or so. And then finally, it will transform into bridgmanite. This is an old cartoon, and as a result, it was written perovskite. And there will be a little bit of calcium exsolving out of garnet and forming calcium perovskite. And then you have ferropyroclase or magnesiosite. What is this? Red questions? This is a dry mineral. That means the stoichiometry should be MgFeSi2O4. However, in the stoichiometry, that means the chemical formula, you should not expect any OH. But this particular thing is infrared spectra, which Rita talked about, and you have OH peaks showing over here. And let me go through this OH peak, because this is going to be a workhorse in most of the labs who study water. SIMS and other methods are there, but this is still a very widely used method, and hence I'll talk a little bit about it, trying to explain you what this axis is and what this particular axis means. So this is my cartoon of an oxygen attached to a hydrogen with a spring, and it vibrates. The atoms are vibrating, and that vibrational stuff is talked about from the seismological perspective. It's essentially like vibration of atoms within a crystal will have the elastic behavior of the material. So this sort of curves you've seen in in Lars's talk, talking about the elastic part and the mimicking the elastic nature by the quasi-harmonic part. The same thing applies for even a bond. This red curve is the elastic part, which is essentially a spring constant, which is vibrating, and this blue part is essentially showing the anharmonicity of the bond. Okay, and if you equate the half mv square or m omega square, which is essentially the mechanical part, and the spring energy constant of kx square, you will get a frequency which is dependent on the spring constant of the bond and the mass of this oxygen and hydrogen together. And that's exactly what you see over here. But why are there so many peaks? This is just for an idealized OH group in perhaps vacuum. However, in reality, when they're in minerals, they're attached to magnesium or silicon. And as a result, you will have these various peaks, which tells us about what kind of defects we have. Have I lost you guys? Or OK, great. And the energy is reported in centimeter inverse. You can imagine that you're probably doing seismology using light waves on crystals. That's what it is. How do we quantify this? So the x-axis, where the energy lies, is something that we understand well. The y-axis, how much water is there, is subject to interpretation. This is, I'm showing it as a linear equation, but this is essentially a logarithmic term. You send a light, infrared light, and that infrared light is attenuated by the interaction of that light through the material. And what you get out is the final signal, which can be related by this sort of equation, which is dependent on the concentration of the material that you're looking in, that is water, the thickness of the sample, and this is something called extinction coefficient, which is related to material property. Okay, how do we get that? Well, in early days, this is a plot of wave number versus the extinction coefficient. Patterson did devise the calibration in which he looked into various hydroxyls in glasses and hydrous minerals, for which water contents were known, and related the height of the peak to the water content and made a Patterson calibration. However, his range was limited, and that range was enhanced by Lipovetsky and Rossmann, and it changed a little bit. Okay, but there are other issues with this kind of calibration, and I'll talk about that perhaps in the later part. The various ways of expressing the water content, you will see in my slides, which I've taken from various sources, it can be expressed as hydrogen by 10 to the power 6 silicon. That's a way of expressing it. You can also see parts per million and weight percent. And this is the conversion that's given for each individual mineral. This conversion is slightly different. We have this, then this is the calibration, then the way we find out water content is having a density factor. This gamma is essentially taking into account that the hydroxyl groups are polarized bonds. As a result, if you send an electric field vector, there will be interaction between that electric field vector and the component of the OH bond. So if you're sending an unpolarized light and the components of the bonds are in some direction, you will get a diminished spectra. You have to do a polarized spectra for minerals. However, if you have polycrystalline samples, oftentimes unpolarized spectras are used. So this is the calibration, and this is what you get from the spectra. So you integrate that, you get the water content. Okay? The challenge is,
I'm going to interrupt.
Yes, yes, yes.
Okay, so if we go back to the calibration.
Yes.
So one more.
Yes.
There. Okay, so that's going, the y-axis, this little epsilon factor.
Yep.
That's a linear axis. Okay, now I see better.
Yeah.
So then how, it doesn't look like perfectly linear. Is it because it's like two different relationships being explored, or are the error bars really huge like they're drawn? And why are the error bars so much bigger at lower wave number?
Good question. I don't have full answer, but I'll try my best to answer. The first calibration was within limited range of material, but if you expand the range of materials, this what happens is that the OH, as I said, it's a spring constant, but that spring constant gets affected by surrounding material. Now, if you have an O sitting there, it'll try and pull this hydrogen because it's greedy for electron. As a result, you form hydrogen bonding, and that hydrogen bonding expands the frequency range. However, the hydrogen bonding, when you go to lower wave numbers, you will see quite a bit of enhanced absorption. That's inherent in the spectra. Don't ask me any more than that. That's my limit, I guess. maybe Lars can expand on it, or perhaps Dan. But so you will have large errors in the region where you are away from the pure OH stretching, where you are going towards more water-rich H2O, more hydrogen bond-rich kind of material. But it's good to have the correlation long enough so that whatever hydrogen bonding condition you find in minerals, you will be taking into account if you take a newer calibration. Am I making sense?
Okay. And then, so typically when we make inferences about how much water there is in mantle-relevant materials, are we working on the left-hand side or the right-hand side of this?
Typically, if you are just looking at the water in the crystals, this is the region where you will find.
Okay.
However, there are some minerals which can go over here in 3000 because they are strongly hydrogen bonded. It absolutely depends on the crystal structure and where the hydrogen is located. What's the surrounding?
Okay. Cool. Thanks.
The issue is with the advanced techniques, one is, of course, SIMS. It's very powerful. It gives you the absolute amount of hydrogen in the material. However, it loses the information of where the hydrogen is. It gives you a number. You don't know where that hydrogen is in what site. Can you draw any inference? Perhaps not. But you can get total hydrogen content that is very accurate. The other method, which same as if you have any questions, I guess the geochemists who know way more than I do, so I won't even go there. So the other method is the NRA, which is the nuclear reaction analysis. You have various ways of doing it. One is, of course, you shine a nitrogen to a hydrogen. It generates an unstable oxygen, and then it generates an unstable carbon, which eventually gives you a gamma ray at a certain energy, and you collect that gamma ray, and that gives you the amount of hydrogen. Having done that for olivine, again, Rossman and Bell, what they found is that this is the Patterson calibration. It's 50 parts per million, could actually mean 2 to 2.5 times more water based on NRA. Okay, so this is the recent calibration. I mean, this is not recent, but this is a calibration that's more readily used now. So that's all I wanted to talk about the calibration, and you'll see what kind of problems it can create. Let's now get back to our natural sample. And what kind of estimates can we make? First, the water in volcanic rocks. There's a range of volcanic rocks, and we have been hearing about the heterogeneity in terms of the major element and trace element chemistry, more in trace element chemistry. You can take water as trace element chemistry, and you will see a variety of numbers there. Mid-ocean ridge basalts, 20 to 200 parts per million. Ocean island basalt, 1,000 parts per million. And island arcs, of course, weight percents of water, perhaps. We don't know what the Earth's interior is, what kind of reservoir sources are, and that's what guys are working on. So if you randomly mix, okay, I don't know what it is, but let's say 25% of MARB and 75% of OIB, you will get 1.5 mass of ocean, plus minus errors. Given this is not my number, this is from the review article which Hirschman wrote in Annual Reviews of Earth and Planetary Sciences. And if you have more amount of MARB, the amount of ocean mass will decrease. And if you have 90% MARB and only 10% OIB, then you have only 0.5% of ocean mass. Giving you the reference of ocean mass, this is something Rita already showed. It's like 1.4 into 10 to the power 24 grams or 21 kilograms. Okay. So that's the range of estimates we can get from geochemistry, based on just looking at the basalt volcanisms. Now let's take a look at the peridotite xenoliths that are brought by basalt volcanisms, and there we have a problem. Hydrogen, as Lowell showed, it has the fastest diffusion, 10 to the minus 10 meter per second square. And this is essentially doing Bruce's spherical turkey experiment. He was talking about water and thermal diffusivity, but here we are talking about hydrogen and a crystal, and how does it diffuse. This is a crystal recorded from a xenolith, and what you see is a hydroxyl stretching frequency shown over here in wave number, and this is the length. How does the hydroxyl amount changes as a function of the crystal? Clearly, you see there is a diffusion profile. This crystal particularly survived because the ascent rate was so high and fast. That's why it survived a little bit of water. So the core has more water, and the edges have less water, which is completely indicating that dewatering was taking place from the side, and the core is probably preserving the some amount of water because the ascent was fast. But that doesn't happen all the time. You may actually lose out all the water that is there. Okay? And that's a warning in most of the mineralogical papers or articles that are written, which talks about this water in the natural rocks. Oftentimes, water might be lost. Water can also be gained. If you are in a kimberlite and there's an olivine crystal there, you can gain water and you can report some water content, which may not be that relevant. Yes, Renee?
So you mentioned that hydrogen diffusion is very fast with 10 to the minus 10. But thermal diffusion is 10 to the minus 6.
What diffusion?
Thermal diffusion, like a typical thermal diffusivity.
Yeah.
So that means as long as you have a thermal anomaly, like the magma is hotter than the surrounding, can we be pretty sure that it should still contain a significant amount of the water that it had before? Because the temperature anomaly has not yet diffused, so the hydrogen anomaly should probably also not have been diffused because it has 4 orders less diffusivity.
Good question. I didn't think like that. So what you're saying is the temperature gradients could be there. So the magma is probably not that hot. Okay, let me address. But we see that.
No, I'm not arguing that there is hydrogen diffusion. I'm just saying that as long as we still see thermal gradients, we probably also still observe the original.
But at least we will agree on this point that diffusion is going to affect, and what you're recording may not be the actual content.
Yeah, I definitely agree.
That's what I want to make the point here. Yes, Bruce. Sure. Okay.
Through a hot region, can we also be sure that the water content is homogeneous through the sample? Because that will certainly affect the rate of diffusion. If you have very small scale heterogeneity, then the connection between the thermal and the chemical might be not related.
Yeah, that's possible. But in an ascent, if you lose, so what I'm going to try and show you is that when the water comes up, there's also a pressure difference. So you have a crystal at high temperature, and it's probably homogeneous. But when you're bringing it up, it's also dependent on pressure. So solubility of water will increase as you go to higher pressures, and that's something I'm going to talk about. So when you are bringing it up, you have less fugacity, and as a result, water is likely to diffuse because the solubility is a product of pressure and temperature. Does it, okay. And that's the kind of equation you can fit in. You can choose a diffusion coefficient, and then you can choose the distance, and you can find out the time of ascent in this particular case. In other cases, you will probably be looking at how much of water is lost. So there is some issues with the natural samples, and as a result, oftentimes mineral physicists resort to experimental studies in lab. But before we do experiments, let's construct some thermodynamics of how water can be incorporated into mineral lattices, which otherwise do not have any amount of, shouldn't have any amount of water based on their stoichiometry. Okay? So the two different kinds of experiments that are done, ideal will be you have a crystal surrounded by aqueous fluid and you see the partial pressure of the aqueous fluid and how much of water you can have. However, real life experiments could be quite challenging. Like I did, I thought that there will be aqueous fluid, but it generated melt. So yes, you can also have hydrous melt in equilibrium with solids, and there you look at the amount of water in the solid, and if the things are equilibrium, that's the amount of water that you can have. Few of the basic things that you've already seen in various lectures, but I will go again through those because it will be a good refresher. You've seen it once, perhaps, or many times, but there's no harm looking at it again. This is a simple reaction, A plus A plus B plus B, and a reaction that whose equilibrium constant can be written as the concentration of A raised to the power of the coefficient. And that equilibrium constant is related to the Gibbs free energy by this relation. So you can express this using this particular relation. We'll be using heavily this particular thing to find out the defect concentration. Particularly water concentration. Lars has alluded to this particular aspect, as is Cheng and Crystal. All of them have written this equation, which is the molar Gibbs free energy, and this is the composition. All you're doing is rate of forward reaction is equal to rate of reverse reaction, and you're equating them with this free energy. And this is another equation that you've seen in terms of G. The del G is related to minus del S del T, plus VDP, both of them have energy terms. I've written them in a smaller letter because they are divided by the number of moles. For an ideal gas, the pressure and volume of an ideal gas is related to the RT term, and there is a molar term represented by N, and if you take the ratio, and I've just changed capital V to smaller V because it's a molar volume, okay? And then what you can do is you can integrate this term over here at constant T when this particular term will disappear, and then you can get a relationship of a pressure. So it's essentially what you're doing is you're relating the free energy, molar free energy, with the partial pressure of the gas. That's what you're doing. That's essentially what fugacity is. So was there a question? Oh, okay. This particular diagram indicates two interesting stuff. Most gases are not ideal. This is a plot for water. What I'm trying to show over here is a tentative box in which there are lots of particles, only two particles over here because of the space constraint. These particles are separated by faraway distances, not much of an interaction there. And that is represented here in this axis. It's L over LM. That's the interaction distance of how the particles are, as the particles are coming together. What will happen is you will reach this one distance where the particle size and the gap between them are of the same size. So there you are actually deviating away from the ideality. And this is plotted over here in this blue line. This would have been the ideal gas behavior in which pressure and the free gas should have been linear. However, there's a significant nonlinearity in the gas as the particles are getting compressed together. So a lot of energy is being stored in the fugacity term, which we oftentimes do not think about, but there are consequences. There's redox melting, as we see in carbon dioxide, coming up from deep interior. The fugacity term itself can drive changes. Okay, so this is the ideal gas, RT LNP over P0, versus the real gas, where we have a term called fugacity. In an ideal limit, when pressure is tending to zero, fugacity and pressure ratio should become one. And then you can go to the literature. This is a work by Dan Frost and Bernie Wood, compilation of CO2 fugacity coefficients and H2O fugacity coefficients. You can write the equation of state of gas as this kind of complex terms. You don't have to worry too much about it. But eventually what you get is this fugacity term from inserting these terms and plugging in the temperature and pressure. How will they look like? This is a plot that I generated. It's essentially modified from the textbook of Corrado. This is how the fugacity changes as a function of pressure. Note that this is a logarithmic scale over here. And when I enlarge this particular part over here, it's a very nonlinear term. And these are essentially the temperature dependence. So fugacity is a humongous energy contributor, which will help defects to get into the mineral if the mineral is able to take them. Now I'll introduce a few terminologies. Unfortunately, I have to do that because if you want to go into the literature, you will find this terminology. So I can skip that, and it will create a lot of confusion later on where the oxygen goes to the surface or it just doesn't happen. So I'll try and account for everything. So this is called Kroger-Wink notation. Many of Colstead's articles and Corrado article and various others will use this sort of notation, so I'm just walking you through that. Okay. This is a species, the main concentration of a defect, let's say. We can have an effective charge of that defect and the site represented by this sort of notation. If it is a positive charge, we'll use a dot. If it is a negative, let's say a single dash, two negatives, two single dash. If it is a neutral effective charge, then you'll use a X notation. Sites could be metal site, M site, MG or FE, silicon site or interstitial site, and so on. Examples, let's say iron with the one positive effective charge, which means a ferric iron, sitting in an Mg site will be denoted by this, in an octahedral site, okay? An iron atom with no charge, effective charge, which means it is plus 2 because it is substituting for Mg plus 2. Does it make sense? I will ask questions then. Sure. I wanted that interaction because otherwise I'll probably finish my talk in a few minutes.
Yeah. Okay, so it makes sense because you're telling us what it means, right?
Yes, like, that's the whole purpose. That's why you...
But like, how do you know? It just says Fe. Like, how do you know that it's supposed to be Fe2 plus and not Fe3 plus in the crystal? And how do you... There's no one even said what crystal it is or what mineral it is, rather.
I'll get there. I mean, if I don't, then I will answer that.
So in other words, my question, I guess, if I formulate it as a question, is this, like, if I see FEXM, this is completely meaningless unless I know what mineral it's talking about.
Of course. Okay. Absolutely. And I'm constructing a hypothetical mineral over here, and then you'll be applying that. Thermodynamics is not going to tell you how much defect concentration it is, but it will tell you the relationship.
Okay.
If this defect is there, then what will be the fugacity coefficient? And I'll walk you through that. So bear with me. Absolutely right point.
Would it ever have like a dot dot or a...
Yeah. I mean, extra charge. Let's say if you are substituting an Mg, which was plus charge, and you are making a silicon go into the Mg site, which has plus 4 charge, dot dot. Can it happen? Yeah, maybe in ringwoodite if there's an Mg and Si disorder. Yes, it could happen. But
cool. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. Yes. Yes. Thank you.
Sorry, so how do you know if it's 2 plus or 3 plus, though? Because I thought the X meant no charge.
No charge. In a lattice where Mg has been replaced by Fe. So Mg already has had plus 2. So it is replacing
like
Mg. So it's a charge difference, effective charge.
Okay.
Don't ask me any more questions. I think I'm reaching my limit. But this is what I have to go through. I mean, Lowell, yeah, you will bail me out, I think. Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
I was just going to say, not only do you have to know what the mineral is, just to add to Ved's comment, but you have to know what it's substituting for.
Exactly.
Because
exactly.
Sometimes you can have like Fe3.
I'm right now going through the nomenclature.
Things, and so you can't really tell what it is unless you know what the substitution is.
M is generic metal site, which is an octahedral site in this particular case.
Oh, geez. Okay. Why don't you make that more specific?
Okay. When I upload it, I'll do
well,
so.
To my next defense, he didn't invent this notation.
Sometimes it's written Me as a metal equivalent. Yes, go on, Dan.
100% sure that you are prepared for that question, which is that I hate the term using water for in this case.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Because it could introduce confusion. What we are talking about is hydroxyl, H plus, not water. Water is a fancy term that mineral physicists use to, I mean, there's some aspect that it is true, but it's not entirely water that we normally imagine that exists just few miles away from here. It is hydroxyl. So
no, the notion is there because when you analyze oxides, what is hydrogen oxide? You could have hydrogen peroxide, and you will make geochemists really angry, probably. So water is a relevant stuff. A loss of ignition will be there in electron microprobe data or water, for instance.
Yeah. So but in
microscopic hydrogen
view, it is hydroxyl. Right?
Yeah, hopefully I'll be able to go there. Yes, Rita.
Is the point of this notation that it doesn't matter what the absolute charge is? Like, it doesn't matter?
It does matter. When we talk about the redox potential and when we go for, you'll see when we add oxygen to it, what does it do? Even without water, there are defects and they are statistically distributed, with or without water. Before the water enhancing, let's say, electrical conductivity or diffusion, there used to be a dominant notation in which you will say, okay, polaron, which is essentially ferric iron. So the electron hole will hop, and that will create electricity. That's for the dry system. So yeah, the notation is there. I didn't invent it. I'm just walking you through so that when you read, you will have it a little easier. Perhaps I don't leave you more confused than that's not the idea. But anyway, does that satisfy? Okay. Ah, tough audience. Okay, this is a hole, which is an electron with a positive charge. When it attaches to an Fe, neutral charge, it'll make it an ferric iron. Okay, this is a vacancy with 2 negative charge and so on, and then I'll construct some mineral lattice. It's a generic mineral lattice, not olivine, not pyroxene, but I'll walk you through. Yes. That's good.
But the hole. Why do you not care what the hole, where the hole is?
We do care.
But you don't have a little notation subscript to it. It doesn't say like hole in the metal.
Ah, yeah. When the hole is attaching to Fe, then it is in the M site. But otherwise, the hole can move through the lattice.
Okay. Okay. So then. Okay. Sure.
Yeah. Sometimes there will be interstitial site notation I. I'm sparing with all the confusions.
Okay, thank you.
You can go back to the original articles by Schock and Duba and others who have worked into this. Same notation, more or less. So here's my cartoon that I made, and there could be mistakes, and I'm ready to work on them. This is my silicon atom with plus 4 charge over here. This is my oxygen atom. They're surrounding magnesium and then silicon. It goes on like a lattice over there. And then what I did is, I don't know whether you can see it or not, these two are my ferrous ion, which is substituting for an Mg plus 2 ion. No charge difference, completely charge balance. Okay? Then what I'm going to do is I'm going to add an oxygen. A half O2 molecule that will create this sort of a hole and oxygen minus 2, and then this oxygen can also be looked, the same reaction can be seen as, okay, this will be going to a neutral site, it will create a vacancy and it will create 2 holes. And that particular hole can then react with an Fe in the metal site, which is my the brownish color atom, and then it will create a ferric iron. And then I can combine all this reaction. I'm writing a redox reaction in which half an O2 is reacting with 2 of the Fe, which are neutral, neutral means they have plus two charge, but they are relative to the crystal, they're neutral. They're creating an oxygen with neutral charge in the oxygen site, a vacancy with minus two charge, and two ferric ions. What does that mean visually? Okay, and then I can write the law of mass action. I can relate the K to the concentration of the ferric ion and the vacancy, and then the oxygen fugacity terms comes in. This is what the redox is. When you look at Klein's paper and he says, well, water doesn't affect, it's essentially oxygen fugacity that affects, this is what the reaction would be. Okay, yes?
But it seems to me that that is quite, you are trying to be general, right? You're trying to say I don't care what the nature of the lattice that this is happening in.
Yeah.
So to what extent is that, and I think that's what a lot of the questions are about, to what extent is that really true? Do you have to attach all this extra stuff to it, or can we learn something from that general statement that doesn't tell me yet?
This general statement is essentially introducing you to the nomenclature, and then I'll show you an example with olivine and perhaps garnet, to show you how this thermodynamics will predict the coefficients and perhaps the absolute number. At this moment, there's no absolute number. I'm just saying, if this is the defect, then what kind of thermodynamics would I expect, and what kind of relationship between the oxygen fugacity or water fugacity will be there? That's all.
I have a question.
Yes.
Surprise. Can we go back?
No effects for our physical water. So that's it. I mean, this is it. Yeah, go on.
Go back. Yeah, there, okay. Yeah. Now I'm going to be super ignorant. I don't understand, so here you write K equals, but then you like, why is there no FEXM on the denominator? Oh, thank you.
When you have... I missed that, thank you. Good audience. So these are one, that's why, because it's whole lattice of crystal. So the activity is there. I mean, there's no concentration change. It's like a sea of oxygen and sea of Fe is there, assuming, okay, 10% Fe, but I'm assuming that it's a lattice which repeats and repeats and repeats. So there's no change in the gradient there or concentration there. Only thing that I'm focused in is the defects. Yes, Dan? I think I'll be done, I guess.
So this is really powerful relation in some sense that you can predict how stable or unstable the hydrogen substitution in the crystal structure that ultimately lead to how much water you can store or not store.
Yeah, I haven't even reached hydrogen, if you guys let me. I'm just talking about the oxygen-related defect.
It's just that he's sort of like getting prepared for showing you how...
You talk to us about hydrogen when there's no hydrogen.
Right. But hydrogen is charged, so... I'm sorry.
Okay, more questions? No, okay. Oh, my. But I'm enjoying it. It's good. Good to have that discussion. But another thing that needs to follow is a complete charge neutrality. You just cannot nilly-hilly make charges and say, well, my is charge balance, because electrostatic charges are humongous amount that I have to. So all the charge neutrality will do is essentially all the positive charges should equal to all the negative charge. And that's the condition over here. I've generated one vacancy. So if I substitute one, that one vacancy is generated by making two ferric ions. So if I substitute one over here, it'll give me two ferric ions. And let me show you that visually. Okay, I'll show that in a minute. This is the entire reaction, half O2 reacting with the metal side, which could be Fe or Mg. It creates a vacancy, two holes, and that extra oxygen that I added, that goes to the metal surface. That will be the activation volume term. You cannot keep putting defects, hydrogen defects forever with pressure. There will be a cost. That will be the activation volume cost, and that will be exalted as an extra oxide. I'll show you that. And this is something that Lowell did mention. This activation volume term is very difficult to assess at higher pressure. There are lots of variations, and as a result, your physical properties will have a lot of uncertainties there. So, to give you an example, oxide activity is controlled by the presence of secondary phases. For instance, olivine is not floating in free space. It is surrounded by either garnet or pyroxene, depending on what your system is. If you look at the stoichiometry of olivine, it's Mg2SiO4. Stoichiometry of pyroxene, it's MgSiO3. There's a difference in Mg and Si. So over here, the silica is more in MgSiO3. Over here, the Mg2, so more Mg. So here, perhaps there's a little bit of silica gradient there. So if you try and create silicon deficiency, it will be difficult, perhaps. It will be easier to create magnesium deficiency for olivine because it's surrounded by pyroxene. Garnet, Mg and Si ratio is also 1:1 because that's why they form solid solution with pyroxene, although there is alumina, but it's Mg3Al2Si3O12, so Mg and Si is 1:1. Here's my oxygen that's added. to the surface. What does it do? These are the two ferrous iron that I talked about. What it'll do is it'll create them as ferric irons, which are equivalent to hole, and it creates a defect. And that defect, this is the activation volume term that will be very important at high pressure. Let's take a pause. More questions. Then, go on. Yes, I knew.
Here, are you assuming that the olivine, the volume of olivine doesn't change before and after the defect is created?
That's the change in the volume. That's the change in the volume. This is the activation volume. You have to take into account. You cannot just simply say that I've added an oxygen and it doesn't go anywhere.
Yeah,
but I mean, you don't see that volume because it's statistically a very small quantity. It is absorbed as an extra phase. That's why the oxide activity becomes very important in terms of constructing these relationships.
Because I thought the activation volume is a volume difference between the product and the reactants. But okay. if you go back to the last slide here, yeah. The reactant and the because you said that this MO is the activation volume, right? The volume is...
This will contribute towards the activation volume because you're taking into account the entire reaction.
Oh, yeah. Is this the volume MO is exactly the volume for the activation?
Give me a chance to show that.
Okay.
Yes, Jessica.
Could you take us back to the picture with all the titles?
Okay. Don't blame me for not finishing anything. Okay, go on. This is the one?
So when you've... The next step on, after you've had this reaction happen,
this
I'm
one.
Very aware I'm about to introduce a bunch of notation in my lecture straight after this, but I'm going to ask anyway. What's the H at the end, and why is it the same color as the Fe3+?
It's a hole. This is an electron with positive charge. If it goes to a neutral Fe, it'll make it ferric iron.
So how is a hole different to a vacancy?
Hole different to a vacancy? It's an electron hole. It's an electron with a positive charge, which is a fictitious kind of term. But what it does is, if your ferric iron is moving in this direction, the hole will be moving in this particular direction, and there will be an electric field gradient. But vacancy is where you had a positive charge, plus two, but it's now vacant, so it is effectively negative two charge, if it is a vacancy in a Mg2+ or Fe2+ site. If it is a vacancy in a silicon site, it will be effectively negative four charge.
So the vacancy is a physical thing and the hole is a theoretical electronic construct?
That's the limit of my condensed matter physics. Don't know. But I guess we can work with this. I'll show you. Let's see some example. This is the model, okay? Just hold on. I shouldn't have shown anything of this. Deal with your own notation. So what I'm trying to show over here is the ferric iron vacancy is now proportional to fugacity, oxygen fugacity. There's no water yet. It is also proportional to the oxide activity and the equilibrium constant of the reaction. We don't know what the equilibrium constant is, but if we can measure this defect somehow and then find a relationship with pressure and temperature, then we can find out what the relationship P and Q are. So thermodynamics is not telling us anything about the concentration of the defect. It's just telling us what the P and Q relationship would be. Then we have to do experiments to find out what the P and Q relation, and then perhaps infer what kind of defects we are forming. Okay. So now I'm adding a water molecule in the vacancy. So I've created another particular vacancy over here and added two hydrogen molecules over there, atoms there. And since I've created another vacancy, I've put another oxygen and magnesium or iron there. Outside in the surface. So I can write a reaction H2O plus neutral M charge, which will create 2H in the M site with the MO surface. It could be either Mg or Fe. I can write an equilibrium constant reaction over here. This is the 2H going into the M site. And this ME is essentially A, it's a typo, same as MO. And then what I can do is I can write the equilibrium constant in terms of delta G by RT, and the delta G will have delta H term. The P del V term, which is essentially the activation volume, and there will be an entropy term. And then I can relate the defect concentration to the fugacity coefficient, which is 1 in this case. So 1 mole of water molecule is creating 2H defects. So now if I plot my water concentration of a mineral and find the fugacity coefficient to be 1, then it is indicative of this sort of defect mechanism. If it is fugacity coefficient of 2 or 3, perhaps some other defect mechanism is going on. Does it make sense? Yes, there's a question.
Why not? Can we go back 2 slides? I just want to clarify.
2 slides?
Something. One more.
One more?
Okay, going back to why there's the same sphere, you know, color for the electron hole as for the Fe3+, I wasn't satisfied with the answer. you should be able to be able to treat those as the same thing, where an Fe3 plus is just an Fe2 plus missing an electron. So there is an electron hole there. So that is very different from having a vacancy, which is a missing atom, you know, in a space. So they are the same thing, but the reason why the nomenclature is different is because we can imagine a dearth of electron moving across through a crystal. It's not just the iron that's going to be losing electron. It could be something else. You know, the electron hole can move around, and that's one way we can think about how electrons are delocalized or traded around. But another way to think about it is to think about it in terms of what's left behind. And so it's equivalent to say in this lattice that there is a hole of electron as there is to say that there is an Fe3 plus sitting there. It's just what view do you take of it?
Can I? This is a long way to go. Didn't even show a single data. Okay, so this is for H2O with M. I can do the same thing with the silicon, but there will be four, there's two hydrogen over here, and then for the silicon, there could be four hydrogen. There could be various mixtures. You don't have to have a silicon side completely removed. You can add an aluminum there, because there could be some aluminum buffer there, and then you can have aluminum plus hydrogen, okay? And then you can write the reaction, and what you see is that in a silicon side, you need to have a coefficient of fugacity of 2, not 1. And then you can construct diagrams like this. This diagram doesn't have any number because thermodynamics does not predict any number. It just predicts a relationship. At low water concentration, the majority defect will be defect due to oxide activity or oxygen fugacity, so holes and vacancy. As the water concentration increases, I've color-coded them in various shades of blue, you will have different kinds of defect activity in which hydrogen could be there in the interstitial side or in the metal side and so on. So, and these are the charge neutrality conditions for each of them. There's no axis, there's no number here. We have to do experiments to put the numbers there, and I'll show you exactly how it looks like, if you bear with me. And this is for the silicon. And now let's take a look at some of the experimental results. Okay, the experiments are done at high pressures. These are multi-anvil devices. This is a picture from Bayreuth in Bayreuth's Gehr Institute. This is a press in which you compress tungsten carbide tubes. Within them, there is magnesium octahedra, which acts as pressure media. Then you put your capsule, in which you are probably having a nickel capsule, nickel-nickel oxide buffer, which is essentially an oxide buffer relevant to the Earth's interior, like quartz phaolite magnetite, if you want to check a reduced oxygen condition, then you will probably have a FeFeO buffer, which will simulate a reduced condition as a core mantle boundary, iron-wustite. You can do these sort of things, and then what you do is you try and hope that the crystal is surrounded by water, and there will be some water defect, and then you look into the infrared spectra of your charge, and then you plot the data of water content, if you have any water, and then you try and fit it with the kind of equations that we worked through. This is how the relationship looks like. Remember, it was a log-log plot. So it was a log of water content or any kind of defect content versus a log of fugacity. Log of fugacity low means water content is less. Log of fugacity is high means water content more. And what you see is that this kind of data can be fitted with an equation which has a form of water content. Again, as Dan mentioned, water I'm using interchangeably. It is essentially hydroxyl groups within the M site. Water content proportional to fugacity power something. And that's the relationship we have to find out. You can take a logarithmic, you can transform this kind of equation to log, and you have log of water content giving the n, which is essentially the slope. In this particular case, it turns out to be 1, which is indicative that it is going into the M site or Mg site. It doesn't tell anything about the delta V, so what we can do is we can take a ratio of this water concentration with the fugacity, and then you will have a relationship in which the delta H can be shoved in a constant. So P del V will have a negative relationship. The slope will give you the delta V. And that delta V, delta V turns out to be essentially volume of MgO oxide, molar volume of MgO, which is indicative that both the fugacity coefficient and the activation volume is constraining the defect mechanism in olivine. It is going into the M site, and the delta V is also matching with that of the MgO that's being exhaled out from the reaction. Does it make sense? Yes.
If that's the case, then your cartoon seems like before and after vacancy take place, the volume of the olivine doesn't change at all.
because it is exsolving out MgO, that's the volume. So your water content volume will not go on forever. It will not increase forever. It will become flat at some point of time because you have the delta V term dominated at the high pressure because you have an extra volume cost.
So how do you define this activation volume, though? Like, is the volume change of olivine before and after the vacancy takes place, or is all exsorbed?
Can we talk about it later? If the rest of the audience is satisfied, I will move on. There's a lot of things that I want to show. I will not be able to, but anyway. Again, this is the olivine data. Then what about garnet and OPX and CPX? There are interesting results. This is for pyroxene with aluminous. Is it right spelling? I can't see. Yeah, maybe a lot of alumina in the Mg site, and these are essentially the infrared spectra, polarized spectra. There is a very interesting and proposition by Hans Kepler. Lars's lecture, you might have seen that the temperature effect could alone explain the lowering of the velocity in the asthenosphere. Just the temperature effect. However, here, this is what you see is the continental geotherm and the oceanic geotherm, and this is the mantle potential temperature taken from some literature. The olivine water content increases somewhat like this, but the enstite water content is humongous, and then it drops down. So at a region where there will be no mineral phase which can take up that amount of water, and if you have water in a hot mantle, nobody is willing to take, it will probably reduce the melting temperature and probably cause meltings. That's the argument that they have used, whether that melt will be in all the grain boundaries or not, whether that will be creating a lowering of the velocity, that's not speculated, but it could probably, water concentration difference between various minerals could generate asthenosphere LVZ. That's what this particular paper is about. Garnet, this is something that I walked on. This is a pyrope garnet. These are aluminum in the octahedral site. The magnesium sits in a dodecahedral site. This is something that you've seen in crystal stock. These are the yellow atoms. I'm not even showing the site. I'll show you that site later. And then silicon sites are over there in the dark blue. Okay. Pyrope is not stable at ambient conditions because magnesium is a very small cation sitting in this large site. It's not quite happy. It's rattling. So you will see magnesium pyrope getting stabilized at high pressure, pure magnesium pyrope. Very odd places you will find magnesium pyrope, perhaps in the metamorphic areas like Dora Mira in Alps. But most of the pyrope will have some amount of substitution of calcium. This calcium is a large fat ion like me, and that likes to sit in large spaces. And in the calcium end member, you oftentimes, not oftentimes, you can get hydroxylar variety of garnet, which is essentially the silicon site is being removed and there are four hydrogens added. So it's found in nature. You don't have to really go into the high pressure experiments. However, when you do experiments on pyrope, pure pyrope, this is an experiment on pure pyrope, it's just essentially showing the same thing. You can have the same data at high pressure and you're trying to fit it with different kind of equation, testing out which site is responsible. So you're just changing the fugacity coefficient to half, which will be an interstitial site, or hydrogen being partitioned into two different sites with some sort of coupled substitution of lithium and boron in this particular case. Or you could have hydrogen sitting in the Mg site. It doesn't fit that well. And you can have hydrogen in the hydrogarnet site, and you'll see that the activation volume difference due to hydrogarnet is significantly large, and as a result, it doesn't fit. So it can give you some sense what data is being explained by your thermodynamics. Thermodynamics didn't give us how much concentration of the water will be. The data is giving us. Thermodynamics is giving us the relationship. This is something that Lars already mentioned in his lecture. Okay? I did. So the problem is garnet is known as a garbage mineral. It can take in everything, but water it doesn't want. I mean, that's a perplexing observation. So what we did is instead of going for Mg-rich end member, when I was working with Corrado, we took a natural garnet from Four Corner Ridge. It had some amount of calcium, some amount of iron, and what we saw is these are the spectra recorded at high pressures. So it definitely has water at high pressures. Definitely had some water because this is an infrared spectra. We integrated this infrared spectra, and this is what is plotted over here. All thermodynamics. I didn't fit my own data. Can anyone tell me why? Because garnet changes chemistry. And all my assumption was that garnet or any kind of mineral, when you want to do this kind of extrapolation of the fugacity coefficient, it will not change its chemistry except for the defect chemistry. But my garnet, since it was a natural garnet, which had calcium, magnesium, aluminum, and everything, and I had the oxide fugacity buffer with olivine and pyroxene as it would occur in the nature, it reacted and garnet chemistry kept on changing towards majority garnet, more silica rich. That's what you would expect in nature. So it's very difficult to fit all data. In my case, there were melts. But there are very interesting trends. One is, of course, that the water concentration is significantly higher than the previous records. This is the effect of temperature. It drops down. This is the effect of failed experiments, which also tells you something. Failed experiment means water probably leaked out. But I also had olivine crystals, which gave me the partition coefficient. And when you have lower fugacity of water, then oftentimes the partition coefficient is such that garnet will have more water. And that may have implication in terms of deformation. Later on, if you want, I can share my comments. These are essentially all data on garnet that were there before. And the data were very perplexing. This was a data by Tony Withers and Bernie Wood. Garnet concentration, water concentration in garnet increases and then drops abruptly and then goes on. This is a data by Hans Kepler and Liu, which found 200 ppm of water. And my data were somewhat like that. I kind of tend to think that garnet water should increase. And then perhaps if you want to explain the majorite, which has some water, it should have some sort of continuous trend. I don't know. There's no experiment over here in this region. So. That's where we are. These are essentially the water spectra for garnet. Could be a potential reservoir for water. And then what is the effect of water on viscosity of garnet? How much do we know about it? If you want to study viscosity contrast in the deep mantle and how does water affect, how much do we know about the water in the garnet itself? Because you know, oceanic crust will be very garnet dominated. Wadsleyite, that's a very interesting mineral. And I have time. So this particular oxygen atom, this is a Wadsleyite structure. Olivine transforms to Wadsleyite. It's a saurosilicate. That means the silicon is attached to form pairs. And it turns out that one particular oxygen is underbonded. By that, what I mean is all the bond contribution from the magnesium atom should match up with the minus 2 charge. But that doesn't happen in Wadsleyite. So there's a natural hunger for some charge balance. And that's why this is the location where you will have a hydrogen atom attached. And now it has been even seen using neutron diffraction that hydrogen is actually in that position. And it can take so much water that you can even have a hydrous mineral type of formula in which the OH is repeating in its unit cell. So you can actually detect that in various kinds of methods. This was proposed by Joe Smith in 1994. And then, of course, the experiments were done. And what was found is that, yes, it can take water, but with temperature, the water content decreases. However, Wadsleyite could be natural. So water content almost decreases to 0.8%, whereas if you have iron in it, then the water content decreases, but it plateaus somewhere around 1.8% or a little bit more. That's Wadsleyite. And this is ringwoodite. It's another high pressure polymorph, and it could have a silicon and magnesium disorder. This is a cubic lattice, and these are some of the spectra which have been interpreted as a lot of disorder between the hydrogen positions, and hydrogen can occur actually at the tetrahedral positions with one magnesium and two hydrogen in these sort of sites. Okay. Then let's go to lower mantle. Perovskite, that's where my journey ends, kind of. This is a study on aluminous magnesium silicate perovskite. The water peaks are very tiny, not sharp. It's a huge lump of thing, which probably is some sort of a disordered water. And I'll show you a careful characterization by Steve Jacobson. And Thorsten is also a co-author of that paper in which they predicted a melt in the 660 kilometer depth. It's a bit lower. That indicates that perovskite could actually have melt. When you have wadsleyite and it transforms to perovskite, then it can generate melt. And that melt will have disordered water. And that's why you have a huge peak here, whereas careful experiments where perovskite was actually surrounded by fluid will have only narrow, sharp peaks, but narrow peaks, which is indicative of the true water in the crystal, which is very low. Effect of temperature is not that trivial. And this is a graph that you've seen from Zicheng previously. What you see is that this is a diagram that I've taken from Hirschman. There's a silicate on this other end, and there's H2O on the other end. So this particular area indicates the water solubility capacity of the mineral. I can draw tie lines, and I can say if the water is in equilibrium with the fluid, this much amount of water will be there, and the water will keep on increasing. But after it reaches the eutectic, then water is no longer in equilibrium with the fluid. It is in equilibrium with the melt. Melt itself has moved the composition over here, which is much less water than the fluid. And as a result, the water content of the melt is governing how much water you will have, and the mineral water content will decrease gradually as you go to higher temperature. That's what you see in Wadsleyite. That's the explanation that I got from Mark Hirschman, and I'm essentially echoing his thing filtering it in a way that I understand. I could have made some mistakes, but you can look up his talk Insider, which is uploaded, I think, in the website. It's a 2006 talk. I promised someone that I will show you some movies about the water in and its reactive capacity. And here's a movie. This is an experiment that I and Bill Bassett did in a hydrothermal diamond anvil cell. This is something that I was introduced by Lars, but later on I followed up on these sort of experiments at Pyrite. What you will see is that there's a crystal of quartz, and this is a crystal of olivine, ferritic rich, and there will be a reaction. This is, of course, at high temperature. No? Low tech. I'm very low tech. Better? Notice this is liquid water. It's roughly around 1 to 2 gigapascal pressure, not much of a high pressure. And notice this shape of the crystal, what the water is doing to this crystal. It's essentially, the temperatures are around 700 degrees centigrade. It's eating up the entire crystal and you have an instantaneous reaction. This is a non-equilibrium reaction, first of all. You're precipitating pyroxene. It's so fast, silica will be simply dissolved by water. So you're essentially in this part of the region, right? So this is not a normal fluid. This has an enormous amount of reactive corrosive property. It will just dissolve everything. So we are oftentimes looking at water solubility in mineral. This is mineral solubility in water because your phase diagram is shifted towards the other end. And it is very relevant because if you are trying to understand the mobility of the high field strength element in a subducting slab, and you are essentially saying, okay, I'm releasing some fluids, but if you're releasing the fluids in the subducting slab a bit deeper, then it is no longer a fluid. It's a supercritical fluid with a lot of reactive properties. It'll be able to take in a lot of HFSE and produce signals in the arc. Okay? Yes? Yeah.
So what was going on with the gray crystal's interior structure?
Repeat that, please. I couldn't hear you.
What was happening to the interior structure of the gray crystal? I could see that it was growing from the outside, but then the interior seemed to change significantly as well.
Good question, yeah. I mean, the reaction is so fast, it's very non-equilibrium. So if you're asking me the question whether the ferrocerite or whatever it was producing, whether it was able to take in water or not, probably it's not because it's very non-equilibrium and the pressure is very low. Just showing you the reactive property of the fluid itself. The kind of experiments that I was showing you through the multi-anvil, those are done at very high pressure, 9 GPa or so. So there, the fugacity term will be much higher. Here, the reactive property of the water is being seen. So I didn't look at the olivine, whether there was water or not. Could be, I don't know. I didn't care. I just wanted to demonstrate to you guys. Partitioning, this is something Crystal talked about. So if you have now water content, which can be described by a thermodynamic relationship for mineral alpha, any alpha, could be olivine, and beta, and if they have similar fugacity coefficient, then it will be fugacity independent. You can just take it out. But if they are different coefficient, then it will be fugacity dependent, and you can write equations like that. So what this particular article has done is they have played very safe, no argument with the geochemistry community. If we take the basalt water content as 200 ppm, then we know what the ratio with the basalt to olivine is, and then we walk all the way down through the partition coefficient and find out what the water content of the total earth is. And the water content are modest. 11% mass ocean for upper mantle, transition zone 45 because of the Watsleyite, and lower mantle 2 or so. It's essentially based on partitioning coefficient, but the tie point is the basalt water content. But that's not always the case. Sometimes we try and make independent estimates based on other methods. So these are the partition coefficients. I will skip that. Lower mantle. This is a subducting slab. If the slab is enriched in Watsleyite with water, then you will generate some melt. This was predicted in one of the review articles by Hirschman. And yes, indeed, this is a diagram that you've already seen, negative thermal expansion as you heat the sample, Watsleyite-containing sample, you will generate a high-pressure polymorph like a perovskite. But this is the infrared spectra, which indicates that yes, there will be some changes in the water content, and you will precipitate brucite. And this is a TEM image, transmission electron microscope image, which can look into the lattice fringes. And these images do show that there could be melting at the lower mantle depth. And that melting may produce this kind of broad hump in the infrared spectra, which will probably, you might think that, okay, it is a melt, it's a water in the lattice of perovskite, but it is essentially the water in the melt. That's what the idea is. Well, is the water absolutely dry in the lower mantle? We are hopeful about some phase which can take up water. Earlier it was said, and I showed you in the hydrous phases, that phase D is one of the candidate phase which can take water in the subduction zone, but there's a new phase which has been predicted by Tsuchiya using first principle simulations, which is essentially solving the Schrodinger equation. Issues with the treating the wave function, so you make approximation and you make it a density functional theory, which means a function of a function, which is essentially a function of electron density. I made you enough confused. You go and check Lars's introduction on ab initio methods in one of the previous CIDR, and that will give you an introduction to the method. But this this particular method says that phase D will transform to a new phase, which has a name phase H, another alphabet we chose, or the community chose, and then that particular phase might dissociate into perovskite plus SiO2 and H2O. And the experiments soon followed. These are all the hydrous phase. These are the slab geotherm. Antigoride is a serpentine, phase A. This will be the field for Watsleyite and Ringwoodite. Then it will be a superhydrous phase B and D, and then D will transform to H, and eventually H will decompose. This phase has uncanny resemblance with the structure of stishovite, which oftentimes goes in solid solution with a phase called delta ALOH, which has a very high thermal stability. And as a result, it was predicted that this particular phase will have a higher thermal stability and could reach mantle geotherm at higher pressure if alumina is added to it. These are experiments by Mike Walter using diamond anvil cell experiments. These are the phase space, MgOSiO2 and H2O, and the L2O3, which will become ALOH. This is what the entire tetrahedra looks like. This is a solid solution between delta ALOH and phase H, and this is D, and the phase D also will incorporate alumina. And they have done experiments in two different classes of chemistry. One is complete NSH, which probably dehydrates phase H after a certain depth. But when you add alumina, the phase stability expands significantly. Does that mean it is there in the mantle? It depends on right composition of lower mantle material. If you are in what it tells you is that if you're enhancing alumina, the phase stability increases. But what will be the effect of calcium, iron? These are unknown. But iron has other phases which are very similar, which will also perhaps enhance the stability through the configurational entropy norm. That's been explored in Panero and Caracas. This is the phase H and delta LOH phase configurational entropy. They explored that and they found that indeed the configurational entropy term will try and stabilize this phase. These are the experimental results for MSH from Walter's article, and they found that it will dehydrate to bridgmanite, whereas if you have alumina in it, bridgmanite and phase H will exist throughout the lower mantle. So that might be a potential host for the phase in the lower mantle. Next 10 minutes, I'll talk about properties. Seismic velocity. Okay, we have water in mantle, nominally anhydrous minerals. Can we detect water using geophysical techniques? This was work done at lower pressures and then extrapolated to high pressures. What you note is that the velocity of dry ringwoodite or dry watsleyite or dry olivine will drop as you add water. However, the compressibility term will be such that it will become almost indistinguishable at mantle transition zone. Same thing for VS, but there was no data so far. So this is a work from Princeton group, and they found similar behavior, and this is the delta V over V in percentage and how water will affect the velocity of olivine. And there's little effect, but not much at the transition zone depth. Then this is a recent work that came out in EPSL, work from Hauke Marquardt and his students. From Bayreuth, and this is showing different composition in a diamond anvil cell. Four different compositions been explored with water and iron, and the effects are such that it will probably almost disappear at high pressure conditions. So even if there's water, you will not be able to tell just by looking at the elastic part of the wave velocity. They've gone further. This is a scale of pressure, and what you see is that lower pressure, yes, of course, if you introduce the amount of water, there will be some kind of gradient there. But as you go to higher pressures relevant for the mantle transition zone, you see that the effect is diminishing for Watsleyite. I had another slide. Oh, yeah, makes sense why I put that. Okay, that's velocity. What about the sharpness of the transition zone? What happens is that if you have water enriched in the transition zone, then it'll try and enhance the stability field of Watsleyite with respect to olivine. And as a result, the sharpness of the transition zone will get affected. And this is a work in which you have on one side Mg2SiO4, on the other side you have Fe2SiO4, and it is done with some amount of water. The sharpness of the transition zone is essentially this two-phase field. For a dry, it will be almost like 7 kilometer. If you make it wet, it will be almost 11 kilometer. But you will have to have a constant temperature. If you vary the temperature, temperature will also affect the width of the transition zone. So folks have used this sort of things to find out, okay, well, can we measure how much water content is there? The idea was first proposed by Wood, and then it explored by Smith and Frost. And then there's an article by, I think, Susan Van der Lee, who found a lot of diffuse sharpness in some of the Mediterranean areas and concluded that there could be lots of water. However, this is a very temperature-dependent and water-dependent kind of a phenomena. Ringwoodite, the elastic velocities are also such that it will go and become almost invisible at the transition zone depth. So the idea is if you want to invert parameters, let's say the height and the velocity contrast, that is delta H by H and delta V by V, either VP or VS, and if you want to invert that for temperature and water content, the water content is not very sensitive, so your inversion may not give you the right results, particularly from these sort of data sets. Then, of course, viscosity. This is a compilation of work. There's an enormous amount of work done in the literature, and I have not done them myself, so I cannot say much about it. But what you see is that the strain rate, which you are all interested about, essentially, which can be related to power law equations and which have all the grain size parameters and so on, strain rate is dependent on the fugacity. If we have looked through all the defect, with painstaking defect thermodynamics, this fugacity term is a very, very common term. How does a complete non-equilibrium process depend on fugacity? The idea that's been proposed is that when you have dislocation, which is essentially a topic that Lowell is an expert on and has given a very nice introduction, and I think what I'm saying is making sense. Correct me if I'm wrong. This is a zone area which is not my specialty. So what happens is that if you have a defect free crystal and if you try and break it, you have to go through the pile stress, which is a very high amount of stress, but that's not what we see. We see much lower amount of stresses can deform things. That's because of the thermal vibrations and various other kind of things, like you have a dislocation plane which is migrating, and if it gets stuck, then it will simply climb. That climb part will have diffusion, and the diffusion has two parts. One is essentially the frequency of jump. The other is the defect concentration. And that defect concentration is proportional to the fugacity term, and that's what you see here. It's a fugacity-dependent term, essentially due to the defect. Electrical conductivity is something that I worked on when I was in Yale. So the idea was you have this dry olivine, which is essentially will be electrically conductive because of the vacancy migration and hole migration. But if you want to explain the observation in an atmosphere, the amount of temperature that you need will be unphysically high. So the idea was, okay, if hydrogen diffuses very fast, then you might have enhancement of the electrical conductivity due to hydrogen, and this is essentially predicted using Nernst-Einstein relationship, which is essentially electrical conductivity is absolutely due to the diffusion of hydrogen ions, so they are proportional. The proportionality has some constants like Heaven's ratio, which is taken as 1, and the charge of the diffusing species, and it's inversely proportional to the Boltzmann's constant and temperature. But this was just a proposition by Corrado, and then we did some experiments. This is the dry olivine from Steve Constable's model, which will, of course, have the vacancy diffusion. And this is the dashed line is essentially a prediction based on the Nernst-Einstein relationship using Kolstad's and Maxwell's hydrogen diffusion rates. And this is what you would be expecting. However, the experiment showed a little bit shallower kind of slope. We were happy, but lots of data came out. And it turns out that the way we calibrated our water was using Patterson model. And the way the water is calibrated now is mostly using Bell's model because that's the more accepted model. So our water concentration are underestimated. So if we correct for the water concentration, this will probably shift towards the master curve, which has been proposed recently by Fabrice Goyard and group. But notice one thing, water does affect electrical conductivity, and it initially is slow, and then it increases. As the diffusion the defect concentration increases exponentially, the water conductivity should increase. So it can explain some of the high conductivity region. And these are for other minerals that that have been studied in the lab. I think I'll quickly talk about the redox thing again back. Earlier, there's a lot of interest here in the early Earth, and there have been proposition that the magma ocean might have been very reduced, and there could be solubility of H2. These are experiments. If magma ocean was H2, if we crystallize that, H2 means there's less oxygen is there. If we crystallize that, where will the H2 go? Will it be taken by the minerals? And the answer is yes, it can be taken by minerals. These are studies, again, from Bayreuth. These are essentially showing wave number versus absorption of H2 molecules in a polarized spectra. H2 is a symmetric molecule. It shouldn't even show infrared spectra, but it does, it turns out, because it gets deformed. And these are very tiny peaks at 4,000 wave number or so. This is an orthopyroxene crystal surrounded by oxides. And these are all for all minerals, olivine, OPX, garnet, and CPX, entire upper mantle covered. All of them have a little bit of H2 dissolved in them. Lower mantle, don't know much about it. I think I'll stop it here and take questions. Yes, Nan.
So molecular hydrogen is charge-wise is neutral. So how can you put in a crystal structure?
Interstitial side props.
Okay.
If you can put helium.
So they don't diffuse out during the compression? Because it is notorious for the metallic iron.
No. Whether you saw any documentation about it from their paper.
I mean, the very fact is that it is there. I mean, if it diffused out, there will be more. But it's still there. Less, but it's there. I didn't do the experiments. So, yes. Did I answer your question before, whatever you were asking?
So it's my understanding that as you increase temperature of like a crystalline lattice, you're likely to increase the number of vacancies as well. And so how strong is that control then on the solubility of water if you see solubility tend to decrease as you increase temperature?
Well, that decrease in temperature on the solubility is essentially because what you're equilibrating your mineral with. If it is with aqueous fluid, it'll increase. If it is with melt, it'll decrease. That's the idea. Okay, because your source region should provide with the diffusing species, but if your source is now melt, which has less amount of water, does it answer your question?
Yeah.
That's not my argument, though. That's Harshman's argument. You can look into his talk. Okay. Yes?
I think I just want to follow up. I mean, I will ask the question about the water, about the free water, you know, like the dehydration of the mineral moving out of the slab, and you said you will show some slides, but I didn't see it. So I guess you didn't have time, that's fine, but can you comment on this? I mean, you mentioned the diffusivity of hydrogen, which is 10 to minus 10, it's actually nothing compared to thermal diffusion, but is water the same, or I mean, what are the mechanism for water to get out?
H2O water, I think the diffusion might be slower because you're not just having hydrogen, you have oxygen with it, bigger. But I think what I was trying to say is that if you are releasing water at depth, it's no longer a normal water. It is a reactive water. It will probably try and produce defects in the minerals that are there overlying the slab wedge, which is essentially olivine. So the olivine will be able to soak up some water, and as you go deeper and deeper, that olivine, enstite, whatever garnet is there, they will be able to take more water if it's a closed system. But if there are other things like grain boundaries, will grain boundaries take water? Yes, it could, because depending on some work done in Colstead lab, the incompatible elements are quite high in the grain boundaries. So
I think I'm more thinking about the water that's coming out of the previously hydrous mineral that can and then the water has to leave the slab to the main wedge. See? And you're talking about afterward. So I mean, how does the water leave the local neighborhood of the crystal, and they move all the way to the main wedge.
It's so that's light. How would the melt come out?
Well, but the slab is cold and strong. It's not. It's different, right? It's either diffusion or it's porous medium. So I mean, what are the assumptions, or what would you know?
And either I am.
It's a very poorly known quantity.
I probably don't have answer for that because I'm probably not fully comprehending the question, which might be very, you know, meaningful, but I am probably not getting it. I think that, you know, water will leave because it's lighter, it'll probably, yes.
Yeah. I wanted to come back to something you said about defects and relating defects to geophysical observations, which is very important, I thought, that your structural diagram showed very nicely that in terms of geophysical observations, the most important thing about water incorporation is that it makes defects, right? It makes defects that weakens the mineral, and that's different from like hydrolytic weakening.
Yeah,
And you mentioned the effect of defects on dislocation creep rheology, but of course it'll affect diffusion creep rheology as well.
Yeah,
and, and also attenuation. And I was wondering if there's any maybe data I was unaware of yet about the effect of water on attenuation yet, what we know about that.
There are two articles, and I think the person next to you will expand on it. I think there are two work by Ian Jackson's group. One was a bit earlier. It was done on olivine in a water-saturated condition in which it did affect the anelasticity. It reduced the anelasticity, but there's a recent paper which Maureen talked about by Klein and others who looked into olivine with water in with the titanium substitution and other things, and they found that, well, the previous experiments were done in a very hydrous environment. Now it is a less amount of water is there, and there's no trend with the water content. It's more of the oxygen fugacity. That's the limit of my knowledge. I don't know how the community is going to accept or, you know, come up with other ideas. That's where it stands. Yes.
Just a question, follow up Josh's question. So for the temperature effects and the water solubility in the minerals, because you show that term that exponential inside there is a delta H and a delta V, and you give an intuitive explanation for the delta V. How about for this delta H enthalpy, activation enthalpy? Could it be lactive so that we have a lactive dependency of water solubility for temperature?
No, delta H is a good question. Delta H is, if you plot 1/1 temperature versus any kind of property, then you will be able to extract delta H out of it. That's exactly what you do for diffusion. That's exactly what you do for electrical conductivity. That's the delta H. Now, whether that delta H is due to the solubility of the defect or the transport of the defect, you can tease out those terms. But delta H, you will have to plot with temperature, inverse temperature, 1/T or 10,000/T. Delta V is, of course, pressure-dependent terms.
But I'm more like for solubility, like because the science paper you show in 2007, it shows a negative dependency of temperature and solubility. If you look at their shallow part, so it's like when the temperature increase in their experiment, it seems like the water solubility decrease.
Could you tell me which paper? I may not be aware of this.
Mia Dell?
Oh
yeah, dead people.
Okay, I'll have to look into it.
Oh, okay.
There are various exponential terms that can be decoupled, and exactly what they were referring to, I have to look into it. I probably am not.
For most of minerals, delta H is positive or negative.
Delta H should be positive because it is a temperature dependent term, yeah. Yes. Sure.
So this is kind of a basic question.
That's the most hard one.
So if you had a stagnant planet where there wasn't any dynamics, any exchange of the surface to the interior, I mean, what's driving the defects to happen in the first place? Would there not be that much of an effect of defects? Or do you need things like subduction bringing all these interesting, you know, calciums and aluminums down into something like the transition zone to drive these atoms into these crystals, and then the defects happen? If your planet's not convecting or anything, then will these defects not are expected to occur?
Very nice question, hypothetical question, so I'll give you a hypothetical answer. If, let's say, the magma ocean contains some amount of water, either in the form of H2O or H2, and then the magma ocean starts crystallizing, the first question to ask is, what is the solubility of water or H2 in the magma ocean itself? If it is, then as it crystallizes, then you will, and there's no, let's say there's no convection, there's no, it's a stagnant lid, as you said. If it is crystallizing, then I'll have to say what kind of pressure temperature regime it's crystallizing. If it is deep, then the chances of forming defects into the crystalline structures will be more. If it is shallow, that will depend on how the adiabat intersects with that particular composition of the magma ocean, and as Lars has talked about it. So it will depend on where the crystallization starts. If it is deeper, then perhaps chances of crystals absorbing that amount of water or H2, depending on what the oxidation state is, going to be high. If it is if it